Well, for the last little bit there, was it disconnected for you? Are you yeah. Are you listening to the Skype signal or the...
The Skype signal. Occasionally I bring up the stream. I'm not sure, but I got a sense that you and I had a stronger strike Skype signal than really happening. Is that right?
Yeah. And then, yeah.
Oh yeah, mine was all broken.
Is that because of your computer maybe? Because it's not as powerful or something? Or your...
Yeah, I'm having a lot of problems with a lot of problems.
Quill. I'm gonna have to turn it over to the proper dump site, but
I shall say goodbye and thanks once again, Curly Language, for being our man as well.
Oh, thank you for being our man in Montreal.
Okay, and thank you, Rudy, for being our man in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
All right. Have a good day, you guys.
Okay.
Cool. See you later. See you later.
All right. So I came here to give you my demo. I just worship you. Take a listen.
And that's the end of the Jam with Manlisher for this week. But Wayne isn't here yet to take over for Art Space Noise Space. So I'm just going to continue to jam for a bit while I figure out something to play. But Wayne isn't here yet to take over for Art Space Noise Space, so I'm just going to continue to jam for a bit while I figure out something to play. But Wayne isn't here yet to take over for Art Space Noise Space.
Too many programs right here.
I'm just
going to. Too many programs going through your head right
while I figure out something to play.
Right here. Too many programs right here.
Is a Bruce call. It is a deadly call.
Speaking on behalf of the Peterborough chapter of Capital International, to tell you that you're listening to Trent Radio, 92.7 FM, quality programming for the Peterborough community. Oh, turn that music down, please. That music down, please. It's hurting my ears. Turn that music down. Excuse me, I said that was hurting my ears. For the love of God, turn that down. Turn that down. Turn it down! 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 Turn it down!
Down! All right, girls and boys, and those in between, it's Web Madman here at you for another week of Art Space Noise Space. We were just listening to some Tammy Lynn Foreman, and that was the latest of her instant video series that she's been doing with her partner, Lester, who, of course, is an awesome filmmaker. And for those of you that caught it on Wednesday night, Lester's film 12 debuted on CBC News World, which is very exciting. And that, of course, does have a very strong Art Space connection. Art Space is heavily featured in that movie, actually.
Yeah, it was a convenient place to do the shooting.
Yeah.
And Ego was featured in it.
Yep.
Because she came to Canada when she was 12.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and actually, I've been going to the CBC's website, and there's a forum for their documentaries and stuff. And there's a sub forum for 12, and there's a bunch of people that are like, oh my God, I came here when I was 12 too. Which, I mean, it's, you know, when you think about Canada, it's like our, you know, what percentage of our population is immigrants? So.
That's a good question, but it's a lot.
It's a lot. And given that, I mean, it's a good chance that a number of the people coming here would be 12 years old. So. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of cool that Lester has done this thing that has kind of brought people out of the woodwork. So yeah, it's kind of cool.
And these instant videos, they're up to number 23.
They've
been doing these for, well, is it really one a week?
Yep. So there's 23 weeks now.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is half a year, right?
Yeah.
52 weeks a year? Yeah. So it's over, right?
No, it's just under.
Oh, 52, half of 52 is, oh, 26, sorry, I was thinking 21. Mm. Missed five there. Math, yuck. But yes, they're getting very close to the half a year mark, which is pretty crazy. And as I was mentioning while we were listening, they've been plagued lately with technical difficulties.
Uh-huh, the super looper broke down?
Yep. And then this last week, Lester's computer, his Apple, died. He has a backup, but it's just not quite his whole machine. So,
right, it's probably like an older tower.
Yeah. So it's kind of they're hitting the limits of their technology, which is well, a challenge.
Well, that super looper is pretty crucial.
Yeah. No, Tammy's definitely developed that as an integral part of her music creation, which is kind of interesting because all of these songs are like these are all songs she's done before that are pre-existing, I've heard all of them before, and almost none of them were originally made with the looper.
No, but they were also multi-track.
And that's what I was just going to say.
And
but
these she's all doing live spontaneous.
That's right. Is that the old ones. And in point of fact, there was a couple of live performances she did where she had bed tracks. So that she could reproduce that full sound of the recording in a live setting. One of the first ones she did, which was very cool, is this one called Fire. And it was cool because the bed track allowed Lester to create a locked-in video that was completely in sync. She played on top of that. And there was a really neat moment where the video was lip-syncing to her singing live. So it's very, it's kind of reversal in a really, really cool way.
Yeah, well, any video editing programs will let you sync audio to it.
Yep.
Or a click track from a multi-track analog recording.
That's right, yeah.
Or a digital time code.
Mm-hmm.
But even with Adobe Audition, which is the program I use mostly, You can add as many MIDI tracks as you want.
Right.
And you can also add a video track.
Yeah.
And use this, originally a sound editing program.
Yes.
To do the sound to your video.
That's right.
To edit it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they have it in perfect sync and all that. Now, of course, Lester... I'm trying to remember the name of that program. I can see it in my head. But the one that's really big on the Mac, that for video editing.
Final Cut?
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's his weapon of choice.
Well, I have to say it's a lot easier to sync up sound now than...
Oh, God, yeah.
I don't know if you've ever worked with tape loops.
Oh, yeah.
Reel-to-reels and stuff.
Yep.
Well, of course you have.
Yes,
you've done scratching with modified cassettes.
Exactly. crazy blind multi-tracking,
right.
Which is covering the erase head and just going at it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't sync that.
No, I checked out some stuff in film editing.
Oh yeah.
I never had a finished product, but I sure played with the machine a lot,
uh-huh.
Which is typical of me.
Right.
But this was. Steenbeck, 16mm editor,
uh-huh.
And it had, I think there was one track for film, and then two tracks for sound.
Okay.
And you recorded the sound onto audio tape that was the same gauge as the 16mm film. It actually had sprockets so that it would
sync.
Yeah. And that's what the clapper is for.
Yes.
When you see them doing it at the beginning of the film, it lists what, the scene, the take.
Yeah.
Any information, but the clap is so that you can synchronize the sound
to the actual
to the
spot.
Actual to the action, because the sound is usually recorded on a different machine.
Yeah,
a Nagra tape recorder,
right?
Which is the industry standard.
Yeah,
it was for a long time.
Right, right. There's probably some miniaturized digital thing now that does all the same plus more.
Oh, for sure. But you wouldn't record it on a film camera because they make a lot of noise.
Yeah, well, that's
A soundproofed one. They are available. They're very expensive and very delicate.
Yeah. No, I know. I'm because I'd been in a few films over, especially back in the early '90s, and for sure, I mean, those huge old film cameras certainly make a lot of buzzing, crunching, whirring, and you certainly don't want your mic anywhere near that. I remember the one film that I was in, Tasting Fuchsia, and the guy was carrying around one of those big boxes on his shoulder with the big furry microphone.
Right. Yeah, the Nagra is a cool-looking machine.
Yeah.
Brushed aluminum look.
Right.
Or just flat, plain silver.
Right.
Very, very technical looking.
It does. It does. He looked like something out of a science fiction show, for sure.
Yeah, if you see a reel-to-reel being used on a TV show anywhere, usually it's a Nagra, because it being a TV studio,
they've got
one laying around.
Right, yeah. No, because, I mean, and the contrast is interesting because, of course, the film cameras still look in their own way like the old-fashioned ones with the big, I always think of them as Mickey Mouse ears.
the canisters.
Of the canisters sticking up off the top, right?
Mm-hmm.
I really do think that that's where he got the idea for the look of Mickey Mouse's head, is from a film camera. It's just one of those echoes that I caught way long time ago that, Mickey Mouse's head looks like a film camera. So
I'll have to take your word for that.
The trick is to look at it in straight outline, and the nose becomes the lens, and the ears become the the hands. Yeah,
but that's sort of a silhouette in three quarters view. Sort
that's
of
right.
Thing. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, I can see that.
Yeah, and it was just because at that, my own take on it is that at that point in time, of course, film was sci-fi in that kind of way, right? It was so fresh and new, and people were still extremely mystified by the whole thing. I just remember my older uncles talking about going to the cinema on a Saturday, and with 25 cents, having a complete day of entertainment, including access to the theater, which of course had, multiple things showing, plus popcorn, candy, pop, a whole bit.
Newsreels, trailers, cartoons, cereals.
Yeah. Which, yeah, I mean, it was the precursor to television, right? In that kind of way. Everyone got together and went down to the theater, at least the kids did, and got together and did this whole... I was just hearing about somebody was saying that that was, you know, parents, they would do that, right? Send their kids off to the theater so they could have a Saturday afternoon alone, right?
Right. Here, I'm going to check on our tea.
Okay.
I think it's going to be extra strong by now.
Oh, it's been sitting there. Well, in the meantime, I'm going to, if I can find the thing, I'm going to jump to the instant video blog so I can... read you guys a little bit about that video that we listened to. So if you want to go to instantvideos.blogspot.com, that's where Lester has been keeping a blog on the creation of the instant videos. And of course, it's got an entry for everyone that's been done going back to the beginning. And so the one this week is... it starts out, she's a little bit country, I'm a little bit rock and roll. Oh, what a reference. Rolling that earth globe with one hand and lowering the tripod head slowly with the other. Whew, it's take 17. I'm not writing this on my usual computer. It feels different. First the looper died, now my computer is on the fritz. It keeps making a painful noise, making me wince each time. I have to get it looked at seriously. Making the video ultimately killed it. Making the video was an epic instant video, an epic in instant video standards. The computer cacked in mid-compression. We drove to a friend's house in Toronto to borrow a computer with Final Cut Pro that could open the project I've been working on to output a QuickTime file. The video was uploaded from his computer. I didn't have time to write this blog. This is a project in creation. You are witnessing the birth. Blah, blah. Country City started off as an elaborate idea based on creating a green screen dress effect with fancy lights borrowed from another shoot. It got later and later that night. Then Tammy realized that she had to sing the song another way. I started hating the shag rug I tacked up on the wall behind Tammy. We went to bed. We had too much time to think about it. The effect didn't work. I needed more instant in the instant video. The next day, I am thinking about the instant video story as it was told last week. I'm thinking that Tammy was off to space on a blinking intergalactic transporter in Light's Blink. If that were true, she would see the Earth from space, wouldn't she? My eye catches the glint of the globe in the attic. The globe is so last minute. But that's somehow Country City to me. The green screen heart on the banjo is kept in the video as a reminder of the other idea. And hauntingly, the song stays. And that is the story of Country City by Tammy Lynn Foreman. And a video by Lester Alfonso. And of course, that's available at originalplastic.com. Or you can go to instantvideos.blogspot.com and get the latest info on what's going on there. So that's the scoop on instant video this week. Hold on, I've got a gazillion browsers open here, so let's just kind of like clean up the space, eh? So meanwhile, the other thing that me and Brian were talking about earlier is just the evolution of film and video and such. We were just talking about synchronizing and stuff of that nature. And it's funny because at this point, as Lester was explaining, it's some of the issues that used to be common in the past, such as, you know, dealing with actual physical messy big reels of tape and film. Now it's all done inside of a digital box.
Yeah.
And
well, I want to look into a digital multitrack for the booty.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Well, and I mean, that's getting way more accessible.
There's a digital 8-track... Uncle Jim told me about.
Uh-huh.
He paid about $350 for it.
Okay, that's... See, yeah, they're coming down.
It's incredible.
Yeah. I don't know... I think Tammy's still got the VS880. That's probably what she's doing some of the audio with. Not sure, though, because I know that for a long time that was her main...
What's the VS880?
It's an 8-track digital.
Does it use videotape?
No.
It's a hard drive?
Yes. Unfortunately, an internal hard drive. She got it a number of years ago, and it has a SCSI port on it. She's still trying to find, because it doesn't even have a burner on it.
Right. Yeah. And SCSI is almost a dead format by now, isn't it?
It's very difficult to find. It is very difficult to find. If you've got an old tower, you can get a card for it, but
yeah,
it's certainly not the standard.
SCSI was a very fast way of transferring information before FireWire and USB.
Yeah.
Because SCSI would like every component would plug into the SCSI board.
Yeah.
And you could send information directly from the scanner to a hard drive.
Yeah.
Or in any combination without it having to go through the main board and processor and buffer in RAM.
Mm-hmm.
It just went straight through. So.
Straight through. That's right.
I think there were a lot of synchronizing problems with that. Weird things happened with it.
Yeah. Well, I think that part of it is that it was it turned into an overly complicated system. In that sort of way, as a lot of those things can tend to do. I think that's the reason why now with the USB in particular, it's extremely streamlined now. Like there's, you know, it's very simplified. and the standards are specific as possible in order to keep compatibility rolling, which I mean, at this point is pretty good. I don't know about you, but I've pretty much had no problem plugging almost anything into my USB port and having it be recognized.
That's right. Cameras.
Yeah.
Windows, Mac, anything.
Yep. Yep. Well, and then there's like the cool things like the, have you seen those lights? They're like reading lights that you can plug into a USB port?
USB, yeah. Have you seen the USB vacuum cleaner for your keyboard?
Oh, no, but that just doesn't surprise me at all.
And a USB coffee warmer.
Ooh, coffee warmer. Although I'm one of those people that prefers my coffee cold to burnt. And I'm very particular about that, in that if a coffee's been on a burner for more than 10 minutes, I just can't drink it. It's just, it's gross to me. a while ago, I actually saw this this guy explaining what happens is that when coffee burns, it produces tannin.
Which you also find in tea and wood.
Yep. And this is where Hughes...
And red wine.
Yeah, well, he was explaining that there's like organic kind of stuff, like whether it be wine or whatnot.
Okay, so burnt coffee could make some people really sick.
That's right. And I think that's part of why when I taste really burnt coffee, it just makes my... it almost gives me a headache, because I know red wine certainly does. I don't react well to burnt coffee. But I've developed a taste for cold coffee. It was many, many years ago, actually, that a friend actually... There was some coffee left, and I was actually considering heating it up because it was before. And they're like, no. And they grabbed some ice and threw in. Stirred it up, and it was really good.
It is really good. You can get it in cans in some stores.
Yeah.
I put sugar in iced coffee, and I don't put it in hot coffee.
Right. And I was going to say that sometimes, I'll put sugar or other sweetener in it just to kind of, it gives it a nice drink flavor. Mm. But, I mean, it makes sense. You know, you have iced cappuccino and all those sorts of things. If Tim Hortons has got it,
Then it's everywhere.
Then it's everywhere. That's right. Sort of a side thought that just careened through my head about Tim Hortons and about how it's actually owned by Wendy's.
And it was shortly after it was bought by Wendy's that they came out with that ad campaign saying that shopping or buying at Tim Hortons was patriotic.
I know. Yeah. No, and they've always pushed that Tim Hortons is somehow, you know, supporting Canadian industry, and it's like, well, not really.
Not anymore.
No. That said, I don't think there is Tim Hortons anywhere but Canada. Like, I don't think the franchise actually has outlets anywhere else. Is there Tim Hortons in...
I
don't hear anybody in the U.S. going roll up the rim, so...
No, I don't know. I think there might be.
Yeah?
Because, you know, what's weird is how Radio Shack was a Canadian company.
Right.
It was bought by an American company and became The Source.
Right.
But now there are Radio Shacks in the States.
Right. Yeah, no, it's a weird, weird kind of thing, right? It's the corporate shuffle. especially because a lot of this stuff, I mean, you trace it up and it all has roots in the same sort of thing. It's like, you know, I see it in, as an analogy of like the recording industry and
right.
how it all goes back up to three labels. Even the indies are, you know, owned by, you know, this succession of other, you know, kind of entities.
Well, how many of the products we buy are actually made by or owned by someone like General Electric or right. Westinghouse,
yeah.
who are two of the biggest defense contractors in the world.
Yeah, yeah. And this is where I've been checking into a lot of the stuff on the quote-unquote history of the internet. Recently watched the quote-unquote the original demo that was done in 1968 by Doug Engelbert. And he was actually, and get this, in 1968, he had this screen where there was a video of him. Overlaid on top of it was text where he had what he called this bug that he controlled with a mouse and moved around, and he was navigating through these hyperlinked documents.
I didn't know hyperlinking went back that far.
Yeah, no, you should see it. It's just like jaw-dropping, boring as snot, because, I mean, it just drags on. But just the ideas behind it. But then, I mean, there's one part where he actually has this other guy that's like miles away at another place, and they start to collaborate, where they're able to work on a document together. And that was, you know, kind of, in some ways, the intention behind right. the internet and certainly
live interactive.
Yeah, that people could like collaborate on things together. Wikipedia is actually in some ways the most direct example of what people like Tim Berners-Lee had in mind when they were talking about the World Wide Web. That it was a truly collaborative where you didn't, it wasn't passive, right? You could go and you could look, and if you had something to add or change, you could. You could just plug in and do that,
right?
Which is the case with Wikipedia, right? Is that it's an open kind of editing system, which is very cool. I'm kind of a fan of Wikipedia. But I appreciate it for what it is. And one of the things that you come across a lot in the Wikipedia sort of documentation is that they're not a source for research. And what that means is that any information that's there needs to be referenced. So it needs to come from a book, it needs to come from another website, it needs to come from somewhere else where it can be verified. And that's why sometimes when you go through, you'll see citation needed.
Right. That's yeah. where someone's made a claim that yeah. is not supported by their own documentation.
That's right. And so when you're reading Wikipedia, it's really important to keep an eye on what the references are, right? And a lot right. of times those references have links. So you can actually see Wikipedia as a starting point. So you can get like a general overview and then start digging sure. deeper.
It is a great source of information on yeah. almost anything.
Yeah.
But it does have... the links to, so you can learn more.
That's right.
You go back to the original sites.
Yeah. Or look up the original books or, yeah. And I think that's an important distinction to make, because I know a lot of people that kind of dismiss Wikipedia, saying, you know, like, oh, well, you know, it's just anybody can write that. And it's true, but, you know, that's dismissing the whole structure behind it.
Sure. There are so many people involved. Mm-hmm. Who are using it all the time,
yep.
they can go and correct something. Like
yep.
There was an experiment where some programmers put up fake posts
mm-hmm.
or things with...
misinformation and
misinformation,
stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Lies, nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
And they were fixed within an hour.
Yeah. No, it's exactly true. It does. It's a remarkable system. And, I mean... The other part of it is that I know some people that are, you know, in research who say like, oh, well, you know, like if all this information is available freely, then who's going to support the research? And again, it comes back to, it doesn't negate the research. The research still needs to be funded. The research still needs to be done so that the source material is generated. Otherwise, Wikipedia doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. So it's not a matter of, you know, kind of putting people out of work as any sort of new technological paradigm sure. tends to bring with it is that threat.
Well, it makes the research that's being done, it makes it more useful and more available.
That's right.
But it doesn't, how could it stop original research being done?
Yeah.
I mean, that's like claiming that because you can download music free, nobody's going to record albums anymore.
Well, according to the MPAA and the RAIAA, that's exactly what they claim. That's the other thing. Last night I watched the Steal This film, the latest edition. Yeah. Steal This film is an ongoing kind of documentary on BitTorrent, mainly focusing on the Pirate Bay.
Right, and the legal case that's going on right now.
Well, the court case has ended, but the decision won't be in until April 17th. So that's the due date of
should have done it for April 1st. I expect it's going to be complete nonsense and sound like a joke anyway.
I'm not sure, actually. Like I said, I was looking at the judge and his statements throughout. And I mean, this is Swedish rather than American. And I guess I have a little bit more trust in the Swedish legal system. They seem to be a lot more rational. They seem to be a lot more or less bullied by rhetoric. Uh-huh. And grandstanding, which is exactly what the prosecution was trying to do in the case, is a lot of grandstanding, which the judge took them to task to a number of times.
Right. All right. You also mentioned that the judge seemed to know more about mm-hmm. the whole situation,
yes.
the technology and the way that it's used than the lawyers did.
The prosecutors. The prosecutors, yes. Because the judge actually was... He wasn't a major tech guy, but was very open-minded and wanted to really get down to what was really going on and trying to, you know, truly and genuinely grasp the situation so that he could render a proper verdict. And I think in the end, he did actually... one of the things they're trying to say, they're basically putting across to say that the Pirate Bay is really not much more than an indexing site. And on that front, Google is just as guilty of having links to torrent files.
Or not guilty.
Exactly.
Equally not guilty.
And this is what they're talking about is that there's and one of the keys in there is intent. And one of the things that's been speculated on is that the prosecution did not demonstrate that the folks at the Pirate Bay had the specific intention to violate copyright law, that was not their mandate, that their mandate was actually just to create an open system that people could share files through, period.
Any files,
no matter what it was. And that the intention was not, that didn't have anything to do with sharing copyrighted material. Now, it's interesting because the flip side is that when you start looking at the numbers, and this is something that there was a guy about a year ago went through and pulled out the Motion Picture Association of America, the MPAA's, own numbers for their year ends, and have shown that not only have sales not attendance to movies and the money that they're making from these movies, not only has it not gone down, it's actually been going up. Since BitTorrent.
Well, that shouldn't be surprising.
No.
Same thing happened with cassettes.
Yeah.
And record sales went up.
Exactly.
Because people had more...
Access.
More access to their music that they had bought.
Yeah.
They could put it together on tapes, mm-hmm. make compilations.
That's right.
There was just more to do.
That's right.
So it was more fun.
Yeah.
To buy albums
and
put them on tape.
Well, and then, and you see that's the other side of it, and I talked about this last week, is the long tail.
Right.
And this is the other side of what I'm seeing is that because the one in quote-unquote industry that has been sort of suffering has been the recording industry, right? But if you trace the numbers back, you see that started to happen well before any file sharing, before Napster, before any of this started at all. they were already in decline. And I think that my personal take on it is that the quote unquote mainstream or the, you know, kind of industry run music kind of machine was losing its audience. More and more people were turning to obscure, genuinely independent stuff, not the quote unquote indie label trademark, but actual independently produced stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of fake indie labels.
That's right.
They're owned by Sony.
Yeah.
But they're trying to appear a bit hip and low budget.
That's right. Well, and in point of fact, that's what started to happen through the late 80s when the label started realizing that more and more people were listening to this other stuff, right?
Right.
A decade of bands like REM and punk and all this sort of stuff opened up this whole other thing, like through community and college radio and those sorts of networks.
Yeah, well, I remember those days. I was here then.
Exactly. And so you could see how more and more people were listening to less and less of the top 40 stuff and were starting to look for stuff that they actually appealed to them on an individual level. Mm. And so that, to my mind, was the reason for the decline. And that's continuing to decline because that trend is even further reinforced by the internet. In that, you know, I listened to all... just at the beginning of the show, I was listening to Tammy Lynn Foreman. I mean, she's not signed to a label at all. And, she's a friend of mine. But, the thing that blows me away about Tammy is that I know that if I were to have stumbled across her on my own, having never met her, I probably would have dug her stuff just as much, which is... Oh, yeah. It's really exciting.
yeah, that's happy to find that out.
Yeah. And this comes around to the other thing that they were talking about in Steal This Film, the third edition, is...
Version 3.0?
Yeah. the thing that they were pointing out is that what these industries are really afraid of is that people are going to start making their own stuff. That people are starting to empower themselves to say, we can do this, right? And then that's where the part of the film where they actually start going around and profiling all of these different, you know, basically unknown artists that were just using digital technology to create their own things.
Right.
And bypassing that whole, you know, other system.
Sure. Well, it is obviously getting easier because recording equipment is so much cheaper.
Yeah.
Distribution is cheaper.
Yep.
Free if you're using the internet.
Mm-hmm.
But I think another reason why sales were declining was the switch to CDs.
Oh, yeah.
Now, originally, CDs were really expensive.
Like
LPs, their top price retail was like 10 or 12 bucks.
Right.
And then CDs came out on the market. They were twice as much.
Yeah. Which they didn't need to be, but...
Well, actually, they did have to be fairly expensive at the beginning because there was a really high failure rate.
Okay. Right.
But the technology improved really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's cheaper to make a CD than it ever was to make an LP.
Yes. No.
But the price, if you go into the record store, the price is still the same, isn't it?
It is. No. And it's that kind of gouging and nonsense that has, you know... Now, because the other thing that was pointed out at one point was that there was a little bit of an artificial bubble in the early 90s with music because there were, in fact, a lot of people converting their collections.
Man, those people are such suckers.
Yeah.
This is
I converted most of my cassettes to CD at one point, but
one thing that really made people suckers.
Yeah.
I mean, if you were buying in the mid late 80s, if you were buying a brand new CD that had been produced and digitally recorded,
right,
then it probably sounded awesome.
Right.
But CDs have a different frequency response than vinyl.
Mm-hmm.
And the frequency response is how well it reproduces the sound at each
range.
Of the various frequencies.
Yeah.
The full range.
Yeah.
So if you look at a good pair of speakers will actually have a graph printed on the front of them.
Yeah.
That'll show you
optimum range.
At 500 hertz, it's got a little dip.
Yeah.
And so... If you've got an EQ, you turn up the 500.
To just give it that little bit extra to balance the sound. Yeah.
Right. So When albums are mastered,
right?
What they do is they master it so that it will sound the best
on, the
on contemporary audio equipment,
right?
Like, I've heard really audio freaks actually say that you know, a Led Zeppelin will sound better on a record player from 1970 than on one from the
modern.
80s.
Yeah.
So they were done to the contemporary standards of the equipment that the consumer was buying.
At that time, yeah.
And remastering is, well, it's difficult, it's expensive, it's a very specialized process.
Yeah.
And even the people who can do it can only do it for a couple of hours a day because they're like staring with their ears.
Yeah, that's right.
It's very strenuous.
Yeah.
So it costs a fortune. But they didn't bother to remaster them for the...
For the CDs. Yeah.
They just put the same master tapes on them, and they didn't sound as good as they did on the record player.
No, they won't.
So then, of course, a few years later, they came up with all the same albums all over again.
Digitally remastered.
I mean, they did it right the way they did it right the way they should have done it in the first place.
Yeah.
And all the people who bought CDs are now having to buy the same CDs over again.
No, I know. Well, and then that, again, is, I don't remember where I saw it, but it was when I was a kid, and it just, like, made me realize the nonsense. And it was something about how they were developing some product, but then they had to make it not as good as it could be so that they could then...
Improve it
down the road.
Uh-huh.
And I do. I don't have any doubt that that's actually what goes on in the developing departments of some of these industries, that that's exactly what they do. I mean, it's part of what I was saying before about the artificial scarcity mechanism. There it is right there. It's
so another thing is MP3 players are getting so cheap you can buy them to put on your keychain.
Yeah.
But there are compressed formats like FLAC and OGG.
Yeah.
Which are
far superior.
Superior.
Yeah.
You can compress them even smaller.
Yeah.
And still get a better sound out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And OGG, I don't know about FLAC, but OGG is totally open source.
Yeah. FLAC is as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
MP3 is still, if you build an MP3 player, you still have to pay a licensing fee to the German company that invented the MP3.
Yeah.
With OGG, no licensing fee at all.
No.
So how come there's no OGG players?
Well, again, partly because a lot of the people that, like the companies that are manufacturing this equipment, are very distrustful of open source. They've kind of grown up in a paradigm where it's like if you don't pay for it, then you don't own it. And if you don't own it, then you're liable. Or, you know, you're open to some sort of lawsuit down the road. It's that kind of, it's the closed kind of mentality, right?
Right. Which just doesn't, it's not effective for dealing with the new technology, open source at all.
And this is where there's more and more talk, like, you know, I spend a lot of time on Slashdot and places like that. And there's a lot of talk about, you know, like sort of trying to move the old paradigm,
right?
And how the old paradigm is really like fearful of the new, right? And they just see it all as, you know, free. And how are you going to make money at free? And it's like, well, because what you do is you shift towards being service oriented,
right?
And you start to, rather than trying to box things and sell them, you sell your skill at administering them, right? And so then, what's amazing about that is that it completely flattens the playing field,
and that's what really scares them.
Exactly.
They don't have the power
to keep it centralized. That's right.
That they once had. Yeah.
Like if I were to be developing software on a Windows machine, I wouldn't. But if I was, and I was obviously wanting to try and do it legitimately, so I would have to pay for all of my development software. It'd be thousands and thousands of dollars worth of development software.
Just to get started.
I mean, there's, you know, lesser bits that, you know, pay a few hundred and get a kind of entry point, but you're going to be doing really sucky little programs that nobody wants to use.
Yeah, but you could still get an open source Visual Basic or something.
Yeah.
And write it in that.
Well, now here's...
And compile it, couldn't you?
Sort of, except that there's certain libraries that are specific to Windows that are proprietary, and the only way you can have access to them is to pay the licensing fee.
So, but isn't there a free open source Visual Basic for Windows?
I don't know about Visual Basic, but there are a lot of, like, there's the GCC compiler, which is the GNU C right. compiler, which is it. And the problem is that the open source ones tend to not have access to some of the deeper libraries. That, of course, Windows has a tiered system, as if that's a surprise, right? And I do notice that there are a great deal of open source projects that look really clunky on Windows. And it's because they don't have the full access to all the libraries to develop the software properly. So it's funny because I'll find that, you know, I'll be running a program on my Linux machine and looks great, works fine, you know, and then I'll drop over to a Windows box and go, ew, that looks awful. The GIMP being one of them. The GIMP looks like crap on Windows. And it's, again, because the graphic toolkit that the GIMP uses is open source, and it doesn't implement fully within the Windows environment. It has limitations.
Right, so it's probably slow, a bit slow and clunky, and it does things in a really roundabout way.
Yeah, and it just doesn't look integrated. It looks like it stands out like a sore thumb. Like, it just doesn't look like it's part of your operating system. It looks like something that's kind of like shoehorned in there. And in point of fact, because it is, with the open source developers, they're having to, you know, bend over backwards in these really obscure ways in order to develop for Windows. In contrast to, like I say, you know, like if you're developing on a Linux system, like, you've got access to everything. I mean, multiple libraries to do the same thing, and each one specifically customized for whatever task you have it on hand.
Right, and tailored for not only your specific application, but your style of working.
That's right.
Because there are so many people doing different versions, you'll find the one that's best for you.
Exactly. And this is one of the things that it's funny as well on some of the open source forums. There's people going, oh, you know, Linux will never catch on because it's too many choices. It's not unified, right? They're thinking that it's only through this kind of like making every interface look exactly the same, a la Windows or Mac, they both do that, that people will be able to utilize computers. So it's a shutting down of choice, and it's a narrowing of choice for the sake of this quote-unquote usability. But it's been shown that there's other approaches to usability that are much more effective in the long run.
Right, but there's still an option for people who aren't tech heads.
Yes. Oh, yeah, very
because
much so.
Because Linux in the beginning was, you know, it was only supersonic users
who
would even go near it.
That's right, yeah. But that's where projects like Ubuntu have come a long way. With Ubuntu, in point of fact, you can do everything in the GUI. In the graphics interface. So if you never want to see the command prompt, you don't have to. It's all from the install right on through to using it on a day-to-day basis. Everything is point and click. If you're not trying to do anything extra, if you're not, you know, kind of pushing your machine at all, then that's, you know, a la the average user, then it's perfectly easy. It's more than you need. And then if you want to go in and customize things, you know, like change the way it looks, the way it feels, you know, there's all kinds of little tweaks to everything on your screen can really, in some way, shape, or form, be altered to suit your needs.
Right.
Because I see Microsoft in the same way as, like, it's like Henry Ford back in the day, where he says you can have a car any color you want as long as it's black. Did you know about that quote?
Yeah.
There's another
quote from Henry Ford.
Right.
It's a good thing they don't know how we make our money, else there'd be a revolution overnight.
Yes, exactly.
And there's probably other quotes from Henry Ford relating to exterminating Jews.
Yeah, well, it's...
Henry Ford was actually a raging anti-Semite.
Yeah.
And he wrote a book called The International Jew, which was, the Nazis loved it.
Oh, of course.
They turned it into a full-length propaganda film.
Now,
Nazi propaganda written by Henry Ford.
Right, but didn't he also, wasn't, Because I know IBM was definitely guilty of selling all the, like, I mean, IBM sold and administered all of the equipment that they did punch cards of all of the things they confiscated off of the Jews before they exterminated them, right?
Right.
And that was all done with punch cards.
Well, yeah, they didn't actually sell the machines.
Right.
They leased them.
Right. Which is, yeah.
So they had to have actual, yeah. I mean, they wouldn't be Americans. They'd be a German branch office guys who would go in. But I really find it difficult, if not impossible, to believe that these technicians went into the camps every month to and tune up the machines and never said, do you notice anything weird about that place?
No, it's true. Yeah, and you see, that's the, coming back to Henry Ford thing is that, yeah, like, he's such a shining example of the mentality that really in some ways still exists within that kind of corporate culture. Now, not quite as personal in terms of anti-Semitism and stuff like that, but there's, you know, it's rife with all kinds of prejudices and stuff, more based on class, right? I mean, Ford was probably not a big fan of the Jews because they were his main competitor on certain levels. So, you know, they were the enemy. Whereas, yeah, like the in this day and age, there's not that anti-Semitism going on. Although the flip side of that is that there is, like, there was that Palestinian thing. When was that, last week?
Which thing is that?
It was just basically, you know, basically calling for an end to what is being seen now as an apartheid within the Palestinian state. But I find it interesting that's being pointed to as being anti-Semitic. That anytime you try to show any kind of support for Palestinians, you're automatically anti-Semitic. So there's been this, like, flip around where it's like, hold on, wait. that's, you know, I think sort of, unfortunately, fairly typical for that sort of pendulum swing, where it goes kind of back and forth, where the oppressor becomes the oppressed and the oppressed becomes the oppressor back and forth, which is why all us queers and freaks have to be careful that we don't become totalitarian in the long run.
Like in that Alan Moore comic?
Oh.
The gay Nazis in space?
Right. Gosh, I haven't thought of that in ages. That's so funny. That's a whole other topic. Alan Moore. I just read a big biography on him. Because you know that he's sworn off, like he's not getting any money for The Watchmen and stuff like that. He refuses to have anything to do with it. And before they ever made it, he said, do what you want, but I'm not going to have my name on it at all.
That's too bad. I guess from previous experience, but
yeah,
you know, if he had, I guess he doesn't have control of licensing and franchising that sort of thing.
No.
Otherwise, he could have insisted that he have some creative input.
Right. Although his point is, and I think that it's probably a point that's well made, is that he has written what he's written specifically for the medium of comic books, and that doesn't necessarily translate into film. And if in doing a film, and the main complaint with the Watchmen is that it's too detailed. It's too specifically like the comic book and doesn't actually use anything that's available to it in the movie kind of medium.
Right. It's trying to imitate it as closely as possible.
Yes.
Rather than making a movie.
Yes. That has its own strengths, you know, drawing from and expanding on the original storyline.
Right.
Which, of course, would be the optimum way to go if you were, but again, I mean, something like The Watchmen would have to end up being a series of like six movies.
We're almost out of time. I just wanted to say one thing about a comic writer named Nick Crane.
Oh, yeah.
He writes and illustrates.
Yeah.
But he adapted Dan